Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with Chicago-based jazz pianist Joanne Dougherty. She comes from Kansas City and learned quite a bit here before moving on to the Windy City. She has played on some big stages over the years, traveling with the USO of Illinois, with the production of Jersey Boys, and on stage with cats like John Abercrombie and Randy Brecker. She is a great talent, has great stories, and a great jazz biography. Please dig this story, my friends.
And what I want to do is kind of start out and ask, what is going on with you these days?
I am in Chicago. I live in Chicago. I've been here for about 15 years, but I came up musically in Kansas City. I grew up a couple hours south of there, I kind of got my jazz chops together there. And then I ended up moving here. And since you asked about what I'm doing now, I'm doing a real kind of crazy combination of things where I'm doing jazz gigs, playing in a lot of other people's bands. I do rock gigs. I write arrangements for people. I tour with a group that's kind of a song and dance theater show, oldies show. We've had a couple of PBS specials, and I am music directed and wrote and arranged those. And I'm just kind of, in January, you know, nobody's doing much.
Yeah.
But I'm practicing a lot and just kind of doing strange, you know, odd gigs, you know. Just they all kind of, all these things combine to make a life, you know. So.
It almost sounds like you're replicating the mantra of a lot of musicians these days. You're taking 24 hours and stretching it to like 72 a day. It sounds like you're pretty busy.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, I'm also actually really shooting for some balance right now, too. And I think this time of year is really good for that.
Yeah.
Because it's a little bit of enforced balance. But I used to tour, girlfriend told you about this too, I used to tour with a Broadway show called Jersey Boys.
Yeah.
And that was really 24/7.
Yeah.
More so, you know, and it was an amazing experience that I would repeat. I loved every minute of it. But I also really appreciate my own ability to shape my days now in a way that I didn't have when I was doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I want to kind of backtrack here. You started out in Kansas City and you said you kind of got your jazz chops here. Explain, what happened in Kansas City to really get you going in that direction?
I went to college in Kirksville, Missouri. And there was an amazing teacher there named Rick DeMuzio, who teaches out in Boston now. He's a saxophone player.
Yeah.
And Kansas City was the, you know, I have family there and stuff too. Kansas City was the city, you know, go to the city and see. I love telling my New York friends, like, yeah, when I grew up and moved to the city, it was Kansas City, you know. And it was awesome. It was perfect for me. I would come to Kansas City on the weekends and go to Jardines and, you know, see people like Tommy Ruskin, bless his soul, rest his soul.
Yeah.
And Bob Bowman and Paul Smith and Danny and Rod and all those people, you know, and that was a big part of my education on what skills you need and how you need to behave and all those things about, you know, like I knew how to play music, but I didn't know how to be a musician as a person in a career. So I moved to Kansas City after college, and I had a job. I, you know, worked in an insurance company, but I was out absorbing as much music and sitting in as many places as I could. And it was the perfect place for me to do that because everybody was really generous and open. You know, there's a sit-in culture in Kansas City that there is not everywhere else.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I've had long term gigs here in Chicago, and I couldn't invite people to sit in, even though, you know, it had been my gig for 8 years or something. But it just was not the place. They don't let people sit in there.
Yeah.
And I thought, gosh, if I had, you know, like my upbringing would have been very different if I had if that's what I had faced, because everybody just kind of, you know, was really cool. So. and you know, especially Tommy, you know, and I, everybody else. I just, it was nice to revisit the times that I had gotten to play with him or watch him play, because he was, you know, no question about what kind of musician he was, but he was also just so good at rolling with it. Like, he never rolled his eyes if the gig wasn't happening. He just did his best and was super cool and never too cool for anything, and that was a big important lesson for me as like a 20-year-old.
yeah,
you know, like, yeah. that was really important for me to get then, and he was a big part of that. So
you know, I was an observer in my 20s, and I used to go to the Majestic and catch him and Brahm, and he'd, you know, get crazy later in the night and hit all those bottles and do his thing. And,
you know,
he was smooth, but he came across to me as the kind of guy that was totally hip, but had a bedside manner, and that was just his shtick. And everybody I've talked to since then, I've interviewed some folks, they just talk about how, you know, he could have gone anywhere, and he picked Kansas City, and that he was the lifeblood of drumming in this town for years.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? So,
absolutely.
So, was it a culture shock for you to come from this region to Chicago, as I like to call Little New York?
Yes, it was. It was. I was kind of languishing in a job, and in Kansas City, and I didn't know, you know, I still needed that kind of, you know, to make the leap of just, I'm just a musician. It took me a long time, because I'm kind of a booky smart person too, so I really kind of liked the idea of, you know, I liked the idea of having a job and doing better and going through the world and, you know, doing these measurable things, and being a musician is quite the opposite of that in a lot of respects. So I got kind of stir crazy, and I moved to Chicago to go to graduate school with DePaul, because I thought, well, you know, I'm not really sure what to do, but I'll go back to school. That'll be a thing.
Yeah.
And I had an immense amount of culture shock, because I had gone from living in a friend's house and, I don't know, like, paying in a three-bedroom home where I could park anywhere I wanted. I probably paid $200 a month or something for a bedroom in their house and access to everything. And I went from that to paying big money for one room and a shared bathroom and no air conditioning and no car. And, you know, like, all these things. And, like, my just the way I was used to living was just completely upended. And it was exciting, and it was also just, it was too much for me the first time around. I didn't stay. I moved back to Kansas City after about a semester in school, in graduate school. I moved back to Kansas City because I just liked that kind of living better.
Yeah, sure.
A lot better. You know, I've been able to replicate that in, you know, a lot of, I have a house and a car and a garage. Those things now I have, but I still, when I go to Kansas City, I just drool. It's just, oh, there's free parking, and it's 20 minutes across town, and everybody's nice, and it's easy, and all the food's good, you know, all those things, you know.
Yeah.
So, it's a great place, and it's only gotten, I was just back there in November, and I was blown away by, well, okay, I was also back there in 2012. We Jersey Boys stopped there for probably 3 or 4 weeks. So I got to, you know, I had an apartment and lived in the Western Auto Building for a while.
Oh, okay.
And so I was down in the Arts District and the Classroom District, and none of that was there. You know, I moved in 98 or something, so none of that was going on. And the Power and Light District was just being talked about when I had left town and stuff. So it was really great to come back and to see all these changes and big food culture and all that stuff. But then the second time, you know, just recently, I was back in November, I just could not get over the players, like just how many great young players there are there right now and doing good stuff, you know, just amazing. So.
Yeah, you know, Bobby Watson's been kind of a Pied Piper at UMKC, bringing in talent and, you know, and the thing about Kansas City, too, is you're totally right. Since the late 90s, there's been an absolute explosion of all kinds of different things. I mean, the Crossroads taken off. There's so many venues. I listened a little while back on KKFI, the local community radio, and they were doing a jazz calendar for like the weekend, and it took like 10 minutes. It was crazy.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, that's like OZ. It's like when they start their calendar, it just keeps going.
Yeah.
That is the sign of a rich scene.
Yeah.
That's what that is.
Well, and I guess
that's incredibly cool.
Yeah, totally. And that leads me into my next question. There just has to be, with the length of time you've been in Chicago, what is that like? What's the scene like, you know?
You know, it's really, I'm perplexed by how to answer that a little bit, because I have swum through the scene in different ways, so my experience of it has really changed over time. When I first came here, I was doing pretty much exclusively jazz. So I would start there and say, I was, it's a great place. People are friendly. There, especially back then, there was enough work for everybody. I think that's contracted some. Some clubs have closed, you know, and the older people are always like, oh, you should have been here 20 years ago, you know, all the time. So, I don't want to be that person. There were surprises though, the scene here I found to be much more segregated.
Hmm.
But that has a lot to do with the geography of the city. You know, the city is on the radar for being very segregated. I mean, it's very multicultural, but there are places in the city where it is very deeply concentrated of, you know, particular kinds of people in one area or not. And that I found surprising, I was used to in Kansas City, just, you know, we were kind of more coming up by age group instead of any sort of self-separation, you know, that was a real thrill for me. And, you know, the Blue Room was, you know, just coming up at the time, you know, I got to play there a lot before I left. And that's a really magical place where all kinds of people come all the time, you know, and it's completely normal, you know.
Sure.
Not to say that doesn't happen here, but it seemed to me that if I didn't make an effort to play with lots of different kinds of people, I could easily just stay in one little pocket of people and not have as rich of experience as I wanted. So that was an interesting thing to me when I moved here.
Yeah.
And it's just because it's so much bigger, you know, in
yeah.
a lot of respects.
Absolutely.
And then the interesting thing, too, was how many, like, sub-cliques. And I don't mean exclusionary cliques. I just mean, like, hey, there's a jazz gang.
Okay.
You know, there's also a free jazz group,
yeah.
You know, like a group of people. There's a, you know, the free jazz segment of people. There's a blues jazz segment of people. There's an ECM segment of people. There are people who like to write these kind of tunes. You know, like they're, it's kind of, you can find any kind of real specific subset you want to get into. There's someone else to play with you, which is really, really cool.
Yeah.
So, really cool.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. So speaking of big gigs and big stages, you've done USO shows, you've done Jersey Boys, Dream Girls, Billy Elliot, played with John Abercrombie, Randy Brecker, and Howard Levy. What is it like when you get into either big productions or next to big acts? What's the energy like? How do you go into it? What's the experience like?
Whether it's a club with somebody fancy or fancy, don't I sound country? somebody, you know, unquote importance, or just a club with just the gang, or a big stage. Yeah, I tend to just get excited about all of it, and you know, try to just show up really, really wide open spiritually, and just kind of see what happens. But that's been cool, because the one thing I really have enjoyed about, you know, playing those kind of bigger, like, theater shows, especially Jersey Boys was cool, because the band was on stage quite a bit.
Yeah.
So you got to actually see and get reminded of music touching people and physically changing them in the course of an evening. you know, like you've got to kind of feed off that the energy of, you know, 1,800 people who came in with their troubles and left ecstatic.
Yeah.
And you know, I have also played a lot of gigs, smaller gigs, where you start to feel like no one's paying any attention, and does this matter, and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, to get that reminder of, like, no, this is a valuable service. This is not a frivolous thing. It, like, bringing joy into the world is an important line of work.
Yeah.
And it's, I think I got off on a real tangent there, but that to me has been one of the biggest gifts about getting to do, in quotes, bigger things, you know, and you know, occasionally I get to find out that, like, Sting is taller than I thought, you know, or something like that, so.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just fun to watch and see all these different levels of production and, you know, how much, like, how loose can something be and still come off? And how tightly, like, buttoned up on the corners can it be and still have life in it? You know, those kinds of things I find pretty fascinating. So.
Yeah, that's great. And this is definitely the question to go off on a tangent, because it's wide open, that's for sure. So let me talk to you about when you construct an album. Your latest is Range of Motion. And how do you go into the studio? How do you go into that, I'm going to release an album mode? How does that work for you?
Well, it's funny you mention that, because I have another one I'm sitting on, and I'm really, really inspired to get it out of where it is and into the world at large. So there's another one coming, and I'm really excited about it.
Cool.
Range of Motion, you know, each of them, Range of Motion was really, that the title came later, but that was really about kind of like, hey, in retrospect, I do these different things. I write these different kinds of things. I like writing for horns. I like writing for guitar. I like these different sounds. You know, like here's a kind of a snapshot catalog of my interests and skills. And, you know, it was a little bit of that. And this new one is much more of, hey, let's have a really good time. Let's enjoy ourselves. Let's play this groove we like for a long time, you know. So, but not too long, you know. Got to keep your numbers in the right spot and all those things. But,
yeah.
I try to really assemble a group of songs that I like, and I write a lot of music, so you know that factors into it a lot. It's a way to get that out there.
How do you approach from your very first real professional gig to gigs today, is there less nervousness? How is the wisdom settled in? What's your approach now versus when you started out?
Less nervousness, sure. More mental engagement and less chatter in my head when things are going right. If I'm saying that right.
Yeah.
I think that's something performers have to deal a lot with. I think all of us do have to deal with the chatter in the head, but I think that's definitely, you know, the confidence in your ability to execute becomes less of an issue, and then the focus becomes on your level of engagement, for me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm still, of course, trying to technically do things correctly and all these other things, but I'm worried less about that because I have, you know, more years of more hours under my belt with all these things, and I'm more focused on how present can I be for this.
Sure.
And how can I, you know, if I'm just playing quarter notes, I want to make them the very best quarter notes ever, you know, and can I stay engaged in that level and not get distracted or, you know, any of those other things. And playing with this group I'm playing with, Under the Street Lamp, right now, it's a show, you know, it's a big show in a theater. And the band is on stage with the singers who are singing and dancing and sweating up a storm. But we really have to perform, too.
Yeah.
You know, we can't just sit there and play. You have to play in all capital letters with all your heart. And that, I find, is really something that's been a great experience to take back to just a jazz club or any kind of, you know, even accompanying a choir or whatever it is, you know, just to really get in there and do it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Who are your jazz heroes?
Paul Smith and Bob Bowman. I'm going to start there.
Nice.
And Tommy, of course. Herbie Hancock, Wynton Kelly, Tommy Flanagan, Bill Evans, Keith Jarrett. You know, I went through a lot of different phases, and I'm really definitely much more interested in things that really swing than I used to be. I used to really go ECM, straight eighth notes land, just really loved that stuff. And I really love Stevie Wonder and his writing, and that's been a big part of my jazz playing, strangely.
Yeah.
But just the kind, the voicings he uses and the ways he goes here and there, that's just been something that I can't let go of. I studied, my teacher, Rick DiMuzio, is a saxophone, a tenor saxophone player, so I studied a lot of that. Joe Henderson and John Coltrane and Sonny Rollins and Wayne Shorter and all of their bands and the people in their bands and all that stuff. That's kind of where I came from and really shaped the way I hear things, I would say.
So if you could meet any one of those in that list, one of them, who would you want to meet and why? What would you talk to him about?
Herbie. And I would let him talk. I, in terms of just an overall hero of versatility and constant transformation and constant innovation, I find him to be a really inspiring person for that.
Cool.
You know, got great at one thing, didn't stay put, got great at something else, changed the way everyone did that, moved on, you know, like just that's a big bunch of, he's had a big bunch of influence on everything.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. What's the greatest thing about waking up every day?
Right now is that I'm waking up at home, not in a hotel.
Nice.
I don't want that to sound. I still love to travel. I don't mean that, but I was
sure.
Gone for 18 months one time, and that hasn't worn off yet. I wake up at home and I'm still like, yay! Here I am. This is cool. This is the right place.
Yeah.
And also, one of the best things about waking up is that in my house is a very nice piano, and I get to play it at any time of day.
Nice.
At any volume, and not worry about it. And that's my favorite part about waking up.
Right on. What is it about playing for fans? What kind of interchange do you like to have with them? What's the greatest thing about playing for a group of people?
Bodies moving and people smiling. You know, I do believe art should challenge us too. I don't want to discount that. Art serves so many functions, many of which are to make us really think about hard, heavy issues. But my little corner of the world, what I want to do is bring people happiness and joy, and give them a place where they can experience life without bills and paperwork and laundry and all those things. Come listen to this other thing and go somewhere with me.
Yeah.
Be somewhere else and move around, you know. Like if it's your toe tapping or it's your head, whatever. But just, you know, just to see people physically engaged is really cool.
Right on. So speaking of, you know, action and activity, let's say in 15 years from now, we do another interview just to see what you've been doing. What would you like to say happened to you during that time? What would you like to see happen?
That's a great question. And I need to, this January is, you know, such a rebuilding time for musicians to begin with, regenerating time. And that's one I need to spend a little time on. I've gotten to do some really cool stuff, and I'm kind of regrouping and trying to figure out where to point a lot of energy this year. So, but things that appeal to me, I would really like to just stay involved with great music and keep playing it for people. And I enjoy these bigger formats. I like writing for bigger groups. I really like writing and then playing the music I got to write for people. That's a big thing for me. I don't want to write a Broadway show. I don't mean that, but I don't know. 15 years seems like a long time. But yeah. I know now that I've had a couple 15 years in a row, that it just kind of goes by really fast.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. prompting.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's why we're here. So, final question. In the length of a tweet, 144 characters, it can go up or down a little bit. Tell me who you are.
I'm going to start with a disclaimer that I don't tweet much.
Right.
So, I don't have that internalized as a unit. so, let me give this a little thought. I am a person who loves music and its power to bring happiness to people.
Cool.
And, yeah.
That's great.
That should do it.
That's it. Yeah. That's a perfect tweet right there. But with that, Joanne, thank you very much for your time. Continued success.
I really appreciate this opportunity. And I really appreciate how skilled you are at directing this.
Thank you.
To just make it smooth and easy.
Thank you. Take care.
Really appreciate it.
I appreciate it, too.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in Chicago, Kansas City, and all over America. And thanks to Joanne for her time, candor, and energy. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino on the iTunes Store. Or, as always, you can visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.